Welcome back to the Curtis Research Audio Archive.
It's great to be back.
Today we're looking into the architectural story of the Afrin region in Syria, specifically focusing on how things were before 2010.
Yes, sort of peeling back the layers, looking at the history embedded in the buildings and sites before the huge changes brought by the Syrian civil war.
And we're drawing mainly from a research overview, Afrin Architecture Pre-2010 Research.pdf, plus some other online sources, right?
That's correct. The aim is really to understand the key architectural sites and the traditions in the Kurd Mountain Highlands from that specific period.
So we'll be covering quite a bit. Ancient temples, Roman cities, Islamic influences, Afrin towns, development, and the traditional village styles too.
Exactly. Trying to give you a picture of Afrin's unique architectural heritage and why knowing its pre-2010 state is, well, pretty important.
Okay, let's jump in. First stop. The Ain Dara Temple. Where exactly is that?
It's located about 8 kilometers south of Afrin town. And we're talking Iron Age here, Syro-Hittite period. So roughly 1300 BC down to about 740 BC.
Wow, that's ancient. And before 2010, it was considered quite significant.
Oh, absolutely. One of the most important and relatively well-preserved Aramean or Syro-Hittite monuments in Syria at the time.
Okay, so what were its key features? What would you have seen there?
Well, it had this interesting three-part layout, built on a platform with a portico supported by pillars at the front.
Right.
And guarding the entrance, you have these huge basalt sculptures, lions and sphinxes.
Mm.
Colossal, really.
Colossal basalt sculptures. That says something about their capabilities, doesn't it?
It certainly does. Using basalt, a tough local volcanic rock on that scale, points to, you know, significant resources, manpower, and probably a desire to impress and endure.
And inside, what else was there?
Inside, you found basalt orthostats. Those are large, upright stone slabs, often carved.
Oh, yes.
And these ones had reliefs depicting lions, guilloche patterns, those sort of interwoven band designs, and even stylized windows carved into the stone.
Windows carved in stone reliefs.
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating. And I read about giant footprints.
Yes. That's maybe one of the most unique things. Carved into the thresholds and floors were these giant footprints, about a meter long each.
A meter. Wow. What's the thinking behind those?
The main interpretation is that they represent the path of the deity stepping into the temple, possibly the storm god, Baal Hadad. It's a very striking piece of iconography.
Incredible, like marking the god's presence.
Exactly. And the main structure above the stone foundations was likely mud brick, maybe faced with wood, but that part hasn't survived, obviously.
Makes sense. And there was a courtyard.
Yes, paved with sandstone, and it had a chalk stone basin, perhaps for some kind of ritual use, purification, maybe?
And the overall structure, just the main hall.
Well, there's evidence it was flanked by multi-story hallways, maybe 3 stories high.
Quite complex, then. Built mainly from basalt and limestone.
Primarily basalt blocks for the main structure, sitting on limestone foundations. A real showcase of using those local materials effectively, even back then. Its significance pre-2010 was huge for understanding that whole Syro-Hittite world.
Okay, let's move forward in time quite a bit. Cyrus, now known as Nabi Hori. This place has layers, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Hellenistic founding around 300 BC, then Roman from 64 BC, Byzantine, Mamluk, Ottoman. It's seen a lot.
So, focusing on the Roman era first, what were the major features still visible before 2010?
Quite a few, actually. The Roman theater was a big one. Huge. In fact, 115 meters in diameter.
One of the largest in Roman Syria, I gather.
Yes, second only to Apamea, I believe. The lower seating rows built into the hillside were partly preserved. The stage building, though, was mostly in ruins.
And what does a theater that size tell us about Roman Cyrus?
It really underscores its importance as a Roman provincial city. Investing in that kind of large-scale public entertainment venue shows a commitment to Roman civic life and culture.
And there was also a distinctive tomb, hexagonal.
Yes, a Roman tower tomb, probably 2nd or 3rd century AD, possibly for a military commander. It's quite unique with its hexagonal shape and a 6-sided pyramid roof on marble Corinthian pillars.
Marble pillars. So importing materials too.
Suggests wealth and connections, yeah. Mixing local stone with imported marble. And this tomb is interesting because it gets reused later.
We'll get to that. But first, Roman bridges still standing.
Amazingly, yes. 2 Roman bridges from the 2nd century AD east of the city over the Saban River, a tributary of the Afrin. About 5 meters wide, one had 6 smaller arches, the other 3 larger ones.
And still in use pre-2010.
Yeah.
How'd they last so long?
Roman engineering, really. They were masters of vaulting and used incredibly durable mortar, often with volcanic ash, which helped structures withstand centuries of use and weather.
Impressive. And the city itself had a Roman layout.
You'd see traces, yeah. A grid pattern for the city walls, a main colonnaded street, the Cardo Maximus, about 7 meters wide, and a big southern gate.
The classic Roman grid.
Exactly. Orderly, defensible. They even excavated a Roman house with mosaics and wall paintings from the late 2nd or early 3rd century. It showed a typical planned Roman urban environment.
Then came the Byzantines. Did they build on top or change things significantly?
They definitely left their mark. You could see extensive walls of the citadel, the Acropolis, and there's even an inscription mentioning Emperor Justinian, so we know there was significant fortification work then.
Right, shoring up defenses.
And they built churches. Foundations of a large enclosed church and a basilica were found north of the main street, showing its transition into an important Christian center. They often adapted Roman structures, but added their own focus, especially religious buildings.
And then the Islamic era and the transformation to Nabi Huri. How did that Roman tomb get repurposed?
Well, this is where it gets really interesting. In 1303 AD, during the Mamluk period, that hexagonal Roman tomb was converted into a shrine, a mausoleum for Nabi Huri.
Nabi Huri. Who is he supposed to be?
Local tradition varies. Some say a Sufi saint, others connect him to Uriah the Hittite from the Bible, sort of Islamicized. The lower level of the tomb became his reputed burial place.
So layering new meaning onto an old structure.
Precisely. It became a pilgrimage site. And then shortly after, in 1314, the Mamluk governor of Aleppo built a mosque right next to it.
Adding an explicitly Islamic layer.
Yes. And then much later, in 1875, the Ottomans replaced that Mamluk mosque with a new stone one, which is apparently the only Ottoman-era mosque in the whole Afrin region.
So you have this Roman core, then Mamluk additions, then Ottoman, all focused around that original tomb.
A real palimpsest, yeah. Showing how sacred sites evolve.
But despite all this history, it sounds like the site wasn't in great condition before 2010.
Sadly, no. It suffered quite a bit from neglect, farming, encroaching on the ruins, some illegal building, and definitely looting. Especially after French archaeological work stopped around 1995, and then again in 2008-2009, there were reports of significant damage. Lack of consistent protection really hurt it.
Oh. Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roj Bosch, Hannah.
Perfect timing. Just what we needed.
Hannah, this smells wonderful. Is it the usual blend today? Roj Bosch.
Sound of receiving tea. Oh, thank you so much. Let's see.
What do you reckon?
You know, I think it's really good today. Not bitter at all. Maybe just a touch less sugar than usual. Or perhaps my taste buds are off.
Maybe. I think it's spot on. Perfect sweetness for me. Thanks again, Hannah.
Yes, thank you. Much appreciated.
Right. Okay. So after delving into all that ancient history at Cyrus, let's shift focus to Afrin town itself, which is much younger, comparatively.
Much younger, yes. It really only got going as a market center in the 19th century.
Why then? What kicked it off?
Likely its location. It's central within that Kurd Mountain agricultural area. Good spot for trade. But growth was slow at first, maybe 800 people in 1929.
But it picked up later.
It did. By 1968, it was around 7,000, probably driven by increased trade, becoming more of an administrative hub, especially during the French Mandate period.
Ah, yes, the French Mandate. That had a big impact.
Seems so. The sources say it was developed by France between 1923 and 1946. A key development was the main square becoming the site of the bus station.
The central hub.
Exactly. Suggests the French were focused on infrastructure, connecting the region, making it easier to administer and control trade routes. Pretty standard colonial practice, really.
And how did the town physically grow? Was there a pattern?
The original part seems to have been on a hill slope north of the current center, maybe for drainage or defense. Later on, it expanded across the Afrin River towards the southeast, heading towards the village of Taranda.
Expanding along the river.
A common pattern, following the water source and flatter land.
What about the look of the town? Can we infer anything about the architectural style in Afrin town before 2010? Was it mostly traditional, or did the French influence show?
That's a good question, and the sources aren't super detailed here. We have to infer a bit.
Okay.
Logically, they would have used local limestone, its abundant and traditional building methods. That would be the baseline.
Makes sense.
With the French presence, you might expect some influence, especially in administrative or public buildings. Perhaps more formal layouts, maybe some simplified European design ideas, but probably focus more on function than grand style. Not likely they were building Haussmannian boulevards, you know?
Right. Practicality over Parisian style. More functional administrative buildings and infrastructure.
Probably. stone construction, maybe some concrete elements appearing later in the 20th century, but likely retaining a lot of traditional character blended with some basic planning concepts.
Okay. Now let's move out from the town to the villages, the vernacular traditions of the Kurd Mountain. This sounds fascinating, especially since you mentioned there's not much documentation from before 2010.
That's the tricky part. There's a real lack of specific, detailed study of the rural architecture before the conflict era. So again, we're inferring based on the environment and general knowledge of the region.
So what can we piece together? Materials first.
Well, sticking with the theme, local limestone. It comes from the limestone massif that dominates the area. That would be the primary material for walls, foundations.
And other materials. Wood. Mud brick.
Probably used supplementally, yes. Mud brick or packed earth, perhaps for some structures or interior walls. Wood would be crucial for roofing beams, doors, window frames, though large timber might have been scarce in some areas.
And what about the shape of the houses? How do they build on those mountain slopes?
You'd likely see modest, low-lying structures. Flat or gently sloping roofs would be practical. Maybe timber beams covered with brushwood and then packed earth or clay. Good insulation, relatively easy to maintain.
And the hillsides.
Adaptation is key. Terraced layouts would be almost essential. Building into the slope where the roof of the house below becomes a sort of terrace or outdoor space for the house above it. Very common in mountainous regions worldwide.
Right, I can picture that. And inside, simple layouts.
Most likely. Single rooms or maybe a basic multi-room plan. Perhaps small enclosed courtyards, which you see elsewhere in Syria and the region, could have been a feature for privacy and climate control, but we lack specific confirmation for Afrin's villages pre-2010.
And how are these villages organized? The settlement patterns.
Again, inferring. Villages might well have been clustered around reliable water sources and patches of arable land, especially for the olive groves the region is known for. Organization might have been based on kinship extended families or lineages living close together. Shared resources like pasture land could also influence village layout. Defensive positioning might have played a role in some older settlements choosing spots on hills, but specific evidence like watchtowers isn't highlighted in our sources for this period.
So it sounds quite distinct. How does this inferred style compare to, say, other types of Kurdish architecture or nearby traditions?
That's a crucial point. It highlights regional specificity. This stone-built, terraced style adapted to the limestone hills is very different from, say, the nomadic tents you might associate with some Kurdish groups historically, or the grand urban houses of cities like Slimani in Iraqi Kurdistan with their elaborate courtyards, or even the famous conical beehive houses you find further south in Syria.
So environment and local tradition really shaped a unique style here.
Exactly. It shows architecture isn't monolithic, even within one region or culture. It's a response to place. And, it's worth noting, the trend towards abandoning traditional styles for modern concrete block construction was likely already happening to some extent before 2010, as in many rural areas globally.
Which brings us back to that lack of documentation. Why do you think there's such a gap for Afrin's villages before 2010?
It's a significant gap, yeah. Maybe researchers focused more on the big, obvious archaeological sites like Ain Dara and Siris, or perhaps the vernacular style was seen as just a variation of broader North Syrian rural architecture, not distinct enough to warrant specific study until recent events brought focus to the region. Whatever the reason, it means details about unique local building techniques or variations might be lost.
It really leaves you wondering what specific knowledge and traditions might have existed.
It does, and it makes assessing the impact of subsequent events on that built heritage much harder without a solid baseline.
So, bringing it all together then, this look at Afrin's architecture before 2010 reveals a landscape incredibly rich in history, layer upon layer.
Absolutely. From the ancient Syro-Hittite temple at Ain Dara, through the complex Roman and Byzantine city of Siris, the later Islamic shrine, the development of Afrin town, and the inferred traditions of the mountain villages, you see thousands of years of human activity reflected in the structures.
And that thread of using local limestone runs through almost all of it, doesn't it? A real testament to building with the environment.
It really is. That continuity of material use across millennia is quite striking. It shows how the geology of the region fundamentally shaped its architectural possibilities and identity.
And the story of Siris becoming Nabi Huri, that reuse and reinterpretation of space, is fascinating.
Definitely. It's a powerful example of how cultures interact with the past. adopting and adapting older structures, layering new meanings onto existing places. It happens all over the world, but Cirrus is a particularly clear case study.
But that gap in knowledge about the villages really stands out too.
It does. It's a reminder that history isn't just about the monumental sites. The everyday architecture, the vernacular traditions hold so much cultural information, and it's often the most vulnerable to being lost or undocumented, especially before periods of major change.
So understanding this pre-2010 baseline is crucial, not just for Afrin, but as a general principle.
I think so. It gives us a benchmark. It helps us understand the scale and nature of changes that happen later, and it highlights the importance of documenting these architectural traditions before they potentially disappear or are fundamentally altered.
It really makes you think, doesn't it? What other regions might have similar underdocumented architectural histories, especially in places on the cusp of major change? What unique stories are held within those everyday buildings, waiting to be understood before it's too late? Something for all of us to consider.